From the newsroom of WBUR, I'm Daryl C. Murphy. Welcome to Consider This from Boston, where a booming real estate market is making it more difficult for artists to find spaces to work and live. WBUR arts and culture reporter Amelia Mason has been talking to the people behind a number of efforts to protect the city's creative community from rapid development for her new series, Artists Displaced. She joins us now to talk about what she's learned. Amelia, thank you for doing this.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So what made you want to devote an entire series to artist displacement?
Yeah, I mean, it basically happened because my beat is arts and culture. And I noticed over many years, I was kind of being forced to report the same story over and over again, some version of the same story. You know, a group of artists who maybe have studios in a building find out the building's going up for sale. Or, you know, a small music venue can't pay the rent anymore, that sort of thing. And these crises would happen and it would unite the community. And, you know, I'd hear about it and I'd do a story and people would be protesting it. You know, something needs to be done. And often nothing would really change. Sometimes they could save the building or whatever it was, but usually they couldn't. And I started to feel like, you know, I mean, I'm a musician myself, and I'm part of the arts community here. You know, we know what the problem is. We talk about it all the time. Everybody seems to agree that it's a problem, that it's bad. You know, but why can't we solve it? What would it look like to solve? And so that's kind of the angle I wanted to take with this series, was really look deeply at, you know, possibilities for fixing the problem.
Mm. Now, do we have a sense of how many artists are displaced like this every year?
So we do not have great data on this. The city has looked into it a bit. What they mostly look at are properties. So like how many properties are at risk or have changed over from being used by artists to something else. If you take, for example, just one neighborhood, Alston-Brighton, there's a ton of development happening there. The city estimates over 120,000 square feet of cultural space is at risk for redevelopment, which probably means it'll disappear. And that could impact 300 or more artists and creative workers. The city also estimates over 100,000 square feet of cultural production space, which is maybe slightly different. That's studios and rehearsal spaces. They think that's how much has been lost over the past like 5 to 7 years, just in Alston-Brighton. So that gives you a tiny snapshot of one part of the city.
Right. So what did you find out regarding potential solutions to this?
Yeah, I mean, basically, it boils down to real estate, right? So the thing that I found really the best way to shore up cultural space, and by cultural space, I mean music venues, artist studios, rehearsal rooms, dance studios, shoring up that space, take it off the speculative real estate market, put it in the hands of artists. So that is really the most surefire way to keep, you know, kind of keep the space around. That's not easy, as you can imagine. Real estate is very expensive in Boston. A lot of artists don't have a lot of money. But here in Boston, there are cases of artists banding together to buy a building, you know, where they rent studio space. And that goes back many decades. I actually looked at one specific community in Fort Point called the Midway Artist Studios. They bought their buildings, and it's a huge, huge space. It's actually three buildings that are connected. And they bought it for $20 million back in 2014. It's now owned and run by a nonprofit that they help control. And that really showed, I think, that there are resources, there are ways to do this kind of thing, you know, if you're able to access them, if you know how to use them.
Yeah. Can you break down the process of how Midway and Fort Point came to be? I found that really interesting.
Yeah, I'll try to keep it short because it is really in-depth and I did do the full thing because I wanted to show, you know, what it actually took. It helps that the building was founded back in like the early aughts with the idea of providing affordable artist live work space. So that was established already and I think that helped them. The plan was going to be to make it a co-op. Then the developer passed away unexpectedly. You know, his estate wanted to unload the property. And that's when the artists heard that it was going to be sold and they mobilized. So the thing that they did, which was really interesting, they created their own kind of investment scheme. I guess you could say that makes it sound nefarious, but it's not. where they were like, what can we put in? You know, they asked each other, okay, how much can you invest? And it could be as little as like $1,000, but it could be as much as $100,000. And we'll have a pretty good rate of return. So they sort of promising people that they'll get something out of this. And that didn't pay for like a huge proportion of the money that they raised, but it started things for them. So they all agreed, we're willing to actually put money on the table. And that sort of helped them get going. They got the city involved. They had help from the city. They had a mission-driven developer helping them raise money. So it was a lot of like low-interest loans. There was a grant from the city. It helped that it was live workspace. So that meant that they were eligible for like affordable housing kind of things. Mm. So they really did leverage that. So I would say it's a mixture of luck, city support, a developer that helped them, and really them being very united and very, very committed. They had to raise a lot of money in a really short amount of time.
Wow. So these artists live and work there?
Yes. These artists have large studios that they can actually do their work in, and it doubles as their homes, which is really convenient and allowed Midway to access, you know, those affordable housing loans and things like that. It's not the case for every artist community, though.
Interesting. Do you think this is something that could be replicated for artists in other communities?
Right. Yeah, I had the same question because it just seemed so difficult to do and so unlikely. And I started looking around for programs, you know, other organizations that might be helping with this. I found one called CAST in San Francisco, which essentially helps artists and cultural organizations buy property. It raises the money, and maybe it helps that organization buy back the property, or it just rents it to them at an affordable rate, you know, whatever is possible for that artist community, which I thought was really cool. There are projects like this in the works in Boston. Former mayoral candidate John Barros is working on a very similar organization to CAST. There's also the Arts and Business Council of Greater Boston, which is doing something similar. But it's not easy. Part of the problem is that often artists and arts organizations find out about a building going up for sale that they're renting in kind of too late to do much. I spoke with Melissa Mayer, the city's director of cultural planning, about this.
By the time people are talking about sale, it's been sold or it's really close to being sold.
The other issue is that the city doesn't actually have a way to buy that property or help the artist buy that property. They don't have dedicated funds for this purpose.
What can be done to fix this?
Well, the city is hopeful that the first problem, them kind of finding out about development projects too late, will be helped next year. The proposed budget will have two additional staff to assist the cultural planning director. And so that'll help the city get ahead of the pace of development and know when things might be endangered, you know, before it's too late. Here's Boston's chief of arts and culture, Cara Elliott-Ortega.
We really need to be putting a lot of time into where is cultural work happening now? What does that look like? What's at risk? You know, how are we building relationships from the ground up so that we understand when, you know, a building could be going on the market?
So the second problem the city faces, which is a lack of funds for this purpose, is more difficult, but they are thinking about it. So they're considering ways they might have developers actually chip into a citywide fund, and that could be used to, you know, grant artists money to help them buy property and this sort of thing, you know, offering transformative grants to artists trying to buy their space. And it would also allow the city to develop art space itself.
Well, Amelia, thanks so much for sharing this with us. You know, the series is fantastic. For those of you who haven't had a chance yet, go check it out. And if you did check it out again. So thanks so much for stopping by.
Thank you for having me.
That's WBUR arts and culture reporter Amelia Mason. Before we go, here's what else is going on. The U.S. Supreme Court has officially overturned the landmark case Roe versus Wade, which guaranteed a person's constitutional right to an abortion for nearly half a century. WBUR reporter Martha Biebinger has been talking to local advocates from both sides of the issue, and she is here to tell us more. Martha, thanks for coming by on such short notice. Who have you spoken to, and what are they telling you?
Daryl, I have been speaking to members of Massachusetts Citizens for Life and several abortion rights advocates and providers. There's a predictable, maybe, range of emotions from horror to delight. I think the fact that the decision is actually here and aligns with the leak that we heard about earlier in the spring is still creating kind of seismic ripples. Mm-hmm. across all the political fronts. You know, there's an attorney who's been working on overturning or dismantling Roe versus Wade for almost 50 years, you know, since he first heard about the decision when he was back in college. You know, there are advocates who are actively working the underground network to try to make sure that abortion is still available for people in Texas or Oklahoma or the other states where trigger laws take effect. Now, even in this very blue state, we have a really wide range of opinions and many people who are, I don't know if I'd say in the middle exactly, but just really trying to understand what the implications and ramifications will be.
Now, as you continue to cover this decision in the coming days, what will you be looking for?
We are definitely going to see more legislative action at the State House. The Senate, in a budget amendment, has already taken up language that would try to expand protections for abortion providers in Massachusetts and for people who help women travel to the state to get abortions. Among people like the Massachusetts Family Institute, who have long worked to overturn Roe versus Wade, there are advocates are hopping on calls this afternoon with national advocacy groups to try to understand what their next steps will be. One of the contentious areas in Massachusetts will be crisis pregnancy centers that don't offer abortion but offer other options to women who they hope will not choose abortions. There have been efforts to restrict them in some cities in Massachusetts. Somerville is the only one I'm aware of that has actually passed an ordinance in that regard. The Mass Family Institute and others are going to try to challenge some of those restrictions to be sure that crisis pregnancy centers can continue to operate in Massachusetts. I think there's a lot of uncertain legal territory here about what one state like Massachusetts can do to protect or restrict activity across state lines. That's going to be wide open territory for a long time. And then I think there's just going to be a lot of, hopefully a lot of thoughtful conversations along the way too about what this all means for not just abortion access, but also reproductive access going forward.
Martha, thanks again for stopping by on such short notice. We really appreciate it.
Sure, Daryl. Thanks for having me.
That's WBUR reporter Martha Biebinger. And that's all for today. From the newsroom of WBUR, I'm Daryl C. Murphy. Take care. And please remember, it's okay to log off if you need to. I'll talk to you later. Hey there. A lot of people listen to Consider This at the end of the day, and NPR's up first in the morning. But a lot of the actual news happens in the middle of the day. And the team bringing the best information about that news as it happens is the team behind WBUR and NPR show Here and Now. And yes, there is a podcast version. So, want more of the best news reporting from public radio around the country? Check out Here and Now. Find it in the same place you found this podcast, wherever you listen. Just search Here and Now.